Hello, I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor.
Stay tuned after the news for Philosophy Talk,
the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. What's up today, Ken?
Patriotism versus global citizenship. Is your loyalty to America and Americans more important than the common humanity you share with everyone else on the globe, regardless of their country?
America and Americans? You're lucky if I'm willing to admit a common humanity with Southern Californians. I pay my taxes and occasionally give to Oxfam or some other charity. Get real, Ken.
Stay tuned as we discuss loyalty to country versus loyalty to humanity at large. First, the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor.
Here we are at the lovely studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco. But we like to imagine ourselves as sitting under a tree down at Stanford's Philosophy Corner.
A few friends, some philosophy, and some adult conversation. I like that, John. I like that.
Before long, we'll take your calls. Before we open the phone lines, though, let's set the stage. Ken, what's our topic this week?
It's patriotism and global citizenship. Which comes first?
Well, patriotism. Now, Samuel Johnson said patriotism was the last refuge of scoundrels. That's always been my definition. You got a better one?
Well, I got a less funny one anyway. I mean, think of patriotism as love for country. No, not just love for country because your country's a really cool thing. I mean, America's a great place. A Brit could love America because it's a really cool thing. Not love for country just because it's in your self-interest, but love for your country just because it's your country.
And your countrymen, too. So I mean, as I get it, it's like this. I'm on a lifeboat. For some reason, I'm in charge. There's one seat left. Two people are hanging on the side wanting to get on. One's a Brit. One's an American. So I shove the Brit off and let the American on. That's patriotism, right?
Well,
I don't think I like that.
Well, you don't have to shove the Brit off. But, I mean, think of it this way, John. Suppose that a bunch of Americans had gotten together and built this boat for their common good. And they had done it, this complex cooperative activity. And that other American had participated in this thing, and the Brit hadn't. Surely we could let the American on and say to the British, sorry.
Okay. So there's good patriotism and bad patriotism. Good patriotism would be like you're part of a democracy, a republic. You feel, you conceptualize this as a kind of a contract, an implicit contract between all the people. You're in it together. You build common roads and stuff. I can, and so you owe them the loyalty you do with anybody in a common endeavor. But how about this, Ken? I mean, what if you're in a something that is a republic but is sliding towards an empire and it's run by a bunch of tyrants?
John, this is not a current affairs show.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. But, you know, there is a kind of bad patriotism. Some people think, and the reason they say we should be citizens of the world, you know, cosmopolitans, as they call it, is that patriotism is kind of like racism. It's wrong to favor members of your own race just because they're of your own race. My race, right or wrong, we wouldn't say that. Similarly, my country, right or wrong, that's wrong, too. Some people.
Well, that would be bad patriotism. I mean, whether your loyalty was really not based on a common endeavor, but some common racial or ethnic characteristic, at least by my.
Yeah.
But okay, so now you've talked me into being a patriot, Ken. Good for you. What do I do about it?
You could say, buy American, for example.
Buy American. Is that really helpful? Actually, Ken, we ask our own roving philosophical reporter, Amy Stanton, to follow up on just that. She files this report.
My name is Lloyd Wright. I'm the fixed operations manager for Albera Chrysler Jeep in San Francisco. We have the Jeep Wrangler, we have the Jeep Liberty, the Jeep Rubicon, which is the heavier duty off-road.
Jeeps are American cars. Well, about 83% American. Thanks to NAFTA, some Jeep parts are made in Mexico. But the car is assembled in Toledo, Ohio, and that's a fact the company would like you to know.
Often people will say, I could have bought the X5 BMW, popular SUV, but I want to buy American, and so that's why I buy the Grand Cherokee.
Actually, the surveys say something different. One 2003 poll, conducted by MediaMark Research, shows that Americans are less likely to seek out American-made products than we were in 1998. Does it matter? Well, if you ask the people at buyamerican.com, they'll tell you that buying American is the patriotic thing to do.
My name is Donald Probst, and I'm the general manager here at Buy American, where we sell American-made products on the Internet. Patriotism is only part of it, or if you want to redefine patriotism, the motive behind the website was to help sell American-made merchandise, thereby helping the American manufacturer and the American worker maintain their establishment and their jobs.
So does that mean that buying American products will help the economy?
That is patent nonsense. It is. It's just silly.
Christopher Thornburg, senior economist at UCLA's Anderson School.
Jobs are not created or lost on the basis of trade. On net, we as an economy are made better off through trade.
According to Thornburg, consumers shouldn't try to buy from one country or another. They should just buy. The more we buy from Mexico, he says, the more money Mexicans have to buy products from us.
Trade is a win-win situation for those involved in the trade. And that's true internationally, between individuals, between companies. Trade is good.
If international trade is a win-win situation, then does being patriotic have any real meaning in the global economy?
You know, I'm rooting for the United States like just like anybody is. And I want the United States to succeed. On the other hand, patriotism is really misguided when, for example, we allowed it to, say, cloud our understanding of the world. You know, right now, China is the second largest economy, and they're growing rapidly. And it probably won't be too far in the distant future when China's economy becomes larger than the U.S. economy. Now, when that happens, will we as Americans respond in a negative way? Will we say that that's a bad thing, that they're now bigger than us, and that somehow or other we're threatened by this? That will be the patriotic response. The real response is that growth in China does not threaten the United States. Growth in China is good for the United States because when their economy starts booming, they want more of our products. And I think patriotism can oftentimes lead you to a wrong decision.
Maybe Thornburg's right, and there's not much logic in the economics of patriotism. But if that's true, what does it mean to be patriotic? What do you do with all that, as Merriam-Webster defines it, love for and devotion to one's country? Should we care more about our own fellow Americans than we do about people in other countries? Or is it all just a bunch of meaningless flag waving? This is Amy Standen for Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Amy, for clearing up that moral dilemma. Next time I want a new car, I'll drive to Tijuana and buy a Jeep Cherokee at the local Walmart. Ken, I think we need some help on this. Let's bring in our guest. Deborah Zatz is a colleague of ours in the Stanford Philosophy Department. Professor Zatz earned her PhD at MIT. She has written about the ethics of things like surrogate motherhood and prostitution, as well as today's topic. Besides her research, she's known for her inspiring teacher and her leadership of Stanford's Innovative Ethics in Society program. Deborah Zatz, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Deborah, I know you've thought and written a great deal about the level of economic inequality among nations and whether such inequality is just or unjust. But I want to step back from that kind of thing for a second, and I want you to help us think about whether there's any deep moral imperative that we as Americans should be especially concerned about, say, poverty in the third world. I mean, there's lots of poverty right here, somebody might say. And isn't it all right, morally speaking, for us as Americans to be more concerned with ameliorating poverty here rather than in distant places?
Well, there are a lot of things to say about that. It's certainly compatible with taking everybody in the world into account to think we have special obligations to our own citizens that go beyond our obligations to strangers. That said, we have some obligations to strangers. At the very least, we have obligations not to impose harm on them. And arguably, some poverty in the world is the result of policies that we or the developed world imposes on the undeveloped world. And those, I think, in particular, can't be justified. So that would be one thing I would say to at the very outset. And then I would say that poverty in the United States, while a serious problem, is very kind of off scale with the kind of poverty you see around the globe. Although they're very poor people in the United States, 46% of the human race lives on less than $2 a day without access to sanitation, clean water, enough calories to reproduce their body weight, and so forth.
But Deborah, and, if we managed to get the whole world up to our standard of living, wouldn't we just ecologically wreck the planet in about 2 weeks?
Well, there are two things. I don't think we need to get that we have an obligation to get the entire world up to our standard of living. I think there's a lot we can do to end premature mortality and morbidity and give everybody in the world a chance to live a decent life. There's also been a lot of research that shows that improving people's life prospects, and in particular educating women, leads to declines in the birth rate. So population control and environmental control isn't necessarily incompatible with giving something to the world's poorest.
I understand. Look, I wouldn't want to deny, and I'm not going to advocate any particular position here anyway, but I wouldn't want to deny that, you know, it would be a good thing to help out the poor of the world. But I really want to help. I want you to help us think about what's the source of our obligations to arbitrary people in the world. I take John's lifeboat analogy in our introduction, and I said to John, imagine that this ship was the product of the cooperative activity of Americans working together one with another. I mean, that seems to generate kind of obligations to each other qua Americans, as Americans. What generates obligations to the poor of India or Biafra or Africa or whatever? I mean, how are they surely they've got to be generated differently.
I mean, let me just cut in here. I mean, you've indicated one pretty plausible way is if we've screwed up the lives of these people. But suppose we just quit screwing up the lives of other people around the world somehow, miraculously. Wouldn't we still have obligations to the poor? To go to the lifeboat analogy, isn't the Earth just a big lifeboat that we all stuck on?
Yes. I think so. Of course, you know, people didn't debate this. And I think the easiest obligations to see are the negative ones, not to impose harm on others. But if you asked, what about positive duties to aid? You know, I was very moved many, many years ago by Peter Singer's arguments in his kind of infamous article on famine and poverty, that if you're walking by a pond and you see a child drowning, and you could easily save the child, except your shoes would get wet, and you just bought those shoes and you really like them, I think you have an obligation to go in and save the child. Now, if you ask me, can I prove, you know, through logic or rationality that you have that obligation? No. I think it's a leap of faith to say we are all connected to other human beings in some way.
Yeah.
And that's the cosmopolitan ideal, is that every human being has equal moral worth.
There's a second step in that argument, which is, says that if kids drowning in China and you don't see them, your obligations are at least initially just the same. Maybe you have more trouble being certain or figuring out what to do, but you don't have any more obligations towards the kids that you see than the kids you don't see. And that step's kind of tricky, isn't it?
Yeah, I wouldn't say you have to make that step. I would start with just the idea that you have an obligation. There's a, you know, famous example by Godwin, the anarchist, who said, if two people are drowning and one is your mother and you can only save one, it should make no difference. Well, I don't think cosmopolitanism entails that. I think you can think you have obligations to your children or mother or fellow countrymen that go beyond obligations you have to humans. I don't know what his relation with his mother was.
Well, how about his wife, Wollstonecraft, the great feminist? How did she feel about his saving the other person instead of her?
You know, I think that, so take, you know, your boat example. I think one thing you want to ask is, can you give some reasons for preferring one person that somebody else could understand? And many people who endorse some kind of cosmopolitan ideal also think that we have some agent relative, what are sometimes called agent relative principles, that there's some things because of my relation to the act and to you, put me in a special situation.
We'll take that up some more. This is Philosophy Talk. Is patriotism a worn-out idea? Do we owe fellow citizens more than we owe other occupants of our world?
We want to know your opinion. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Or visit our website, www.philosophytalk.org, and click on the comments link to send an email to comments@philosophytalk.org.
Philosophy Talk continues after this short break.
In case you didn't recognize it, which is pretty unlikely, that was Bruce Springsteen and Born in the USA. I'm John Perry from Stanford's Philosophy Department. I was born in the USA, and so was my boss, not the boss, but my boss, Ken Taylor.
Yes, and together as a team, we bring you Philosophy Talk. This week we're examining patriotism and cosmopolitanism, or global citizenship.
Our guest is our fellow Stanford philosopher, Deborah Zotz.
Now it's time for us to turn the program over to you a bit. You call us and tell us, do we owe American citizens more than we owe other people in the world?
The number to call is 415-841-4134. Or you can visit www.philosophytalk.org and click on the comments link. You can send an email to comments@philosophytalk.org.
Deborah, before the break, you were saying something about agent relative reasons. You lost me a little bit. Can you
go over it slow for these old people here in the control booth, will you?
Yeah.
My relationship to the activities of my government is different than my relation to the activities of other governments. I mean, I'm a U.S. citizen. I'm engaged in a project in the United States as a citizen. So when my government does something, for one thing, I feel much more responsible than I do for harms or wrongs committed by other governments.
Even if you voted against it?
Even if I voted against it, it's my obligation as a citizen to to do my part in making sure that my state acts justly. And when it doesn't, to bear the costs of that unjust activity.
Right.
In the same way that German citizens paid reparations to Jews, whether or not they had supported the Nazis.
Why don't you join us at 415-841-4134. We're talking to Deborah Zotz about patriotism and globalism. Deborah, let me ask you, though. This sounds to me now that you're defending a kind of patriotism, a kind of special allegiance to the nation of one's birth, and just because it is one's country. Is that mm-hmm. right?
Well, I think the two of you, in the way you set this up, put your finger on something, which is patriotism, like nationalism, has benign and pernicious forms. The pernicious form we're very familiar with. It's the indifference to the lives of outsiders, so that anything that benefits your nation is seen as justified, no matter what the cost it imposes on outsiders. The benign forms are ones that celebrate the prospect of a common life together in which people participate in making the rules that govern them.
I'm going to let Melanie in Berkeley, we have a caller in the line, Melanie in Berkeley, participate in our common life. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Melanie.
Hi, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I have a question about the idea of patriotism, because I wasn't quite sure with the way that the discussion was set up, whether patriotism as a concept really implies a relationship to one's fellow citizens, or whether it implies a relationship to some concept of the nation state. Because in the second part of the way that it's been set up, the conflict or the space between feeling patriotic and therefore having greater obligations to one's fellow citizens as opposed to people of other nations. And I wonder if you could talk about the concept of patriotism.
Okay. Thank you very much, Melanie. Deborah, you want to weigh in here at all?
I'm not exactly sure what the caller is asking. I think patriotism, has many different connotations and conceptions and meanings for people. If you interpret patriotism as meaning loyalty to my nation no matter what, that kind of patriotism, I think, leads in the pernicious direction. If you interpret patriotism as saying there's a space for me to have special obligations to my own fellow citizens and to my own state, bounded by the obligations I have to strangers, then I think you can think of a way that cosmopolitanism or, you know, humanism can accommodate patriotism in
John
the same way that... Go ahead.
John wants to get in here, Doug.
No, I want to actually... I mean, I think that I agree with all that. There's room for a positive concept of patriotism. But I want to go back, Deborah, to your example of the Germans and reparations to the Jews. It's somehow... I don't know what to say about it, but I'm not sure that we said quite the right thing. Here is, let's suppose I'm a German, and not a particularly heroic one, but I didn't participate in the Nazi regime. I opposed it, was drafted in the army, lost a leg, lost my family. Maybe I worked for a Jew who was gassed and I lost my job. And at that point, do I really owe reparations any more than anybody else in the world? I mean, in a sense, there's a utilitarian reason to make me pay him, because who else are we going to have pay him? And then there might be a moral reason, because maybe I'm going to stay there and somehow benefit from the property that was taken from the Jews and so forth and so on. But in some sense, isn't it part of our individualism that really me, if I just leave Germany and say to hell with it, I'm just one more war victim, not as bad as some, but I have anything to do with it. What's wrong with that?
I would draw a distinction between personal responsibility and civic responsibility. So you're absolutely right that, many Germans were not personally responsible for the Holocaust. But as citizens, they have an obligation to make good on their state's debt. Yeah. Which is what we do when we pay taxes.
Yeah. Why don't you join us at 415-841-4134. We're talking with Deborah Satz, John, and John Perry, and me, Ken Taylor. We have a caller on the line, Kathy, on a cell phone. Kathy, make sure you speak up.
I guess my concern stems from a video that I show in my teaching in early childhood by Bruce Perry, where he talks about maintaining the social fabric. And even the little things that we do that show caring and concern for our fellow human beings. When I'm driving on the freeway particularly, it seems like people are so insulated that I often talk about all these people who live alone in the world, that far from having cosmopolitan or metropolitan or global responsibility to one another, we seem to hardly be aware that other people are living around us. And I don't. To some extent, I'm wondering whether that mirrors the state and our government and patriotism. I mean, what is patriotism when the government seems to be totally unaware that there are real human beings in other parts of the world and that their policies are causing murder and mayhem, literally, in those other parts of the world? Are we taking that as a role model and mirroring our behavior based on it. So I'm on a cell phone, I will leave you with that and listen to you on the air.
Okay, you've said a lot. Thank you very much, Kathy. Deborah, there's a lot in what Kathy said, but there's one question that occurs to me given her comments. It's one thing, my government's policies and their impact on people in the world, that's one thing. My particular obligations to other citizens of other countries, that seems to me a separate thing. It may be, I mean, I suppose a kind of non-cosmopolitan could argue, sure, you know, there's this community of nations that have relations to one another, and maybe one nation should not do bad things to another. So that's the relations between nations. What do I, though, owe these individuals in this other country? Do I owe them anything not mediated by my relationship to the state to which I belong and their relation to the state to which they belong?
I think you do. But what, you know, how much or precisely what, we know the best guarantor of the rights of humans are the forms of state that people set up. So it seems to me it's right to say the primary responsibility for a people is its own state. But some states don't have the capacity to take care of the needs of their people, either because they're hopelessly corrupt or because they're involved in ethnic cleansing and genocides, or because they lack the material conditions under which to provide for the basic needs of their people. And in those cases, I think some of the burden falls on us, simply as other human beings.
Well, Deborah, I find that as a human being pretty persuasive. But then when I think back about the 20th century and America's involvement, I think, gosh, these wonderful motives could be credited with a lot of terrible things. I mean, Woodrow Wilson thought that we ought to get involved in this war in Europe, where all these antiquated, non-democratic nations were beating each other up. But what good did that do? It just led to World War II, as far as I can see. Wouldn't it be better just to mind our own business and quit interfering with others and try to make our nation as good as possible?
I'm going to leave that question hanging and let a caller in here. Gregory in Concord is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Gregory.
Hi, thank you very much. My name is Gregory Johnson. I was a defendant some years ago in the U.S. Supreme Court flag-burning case. I was tried and convicted in Texas for burning the American flag at a Republican national convention, a protest against the convention when Reagan was being renominated in 1984. And I was just driving, and I heard your show, and I wanted to call in. I wanted to say around patriotism that I think it's very important that people look to the people of the world first. I think if you begin to imagine a world without America, without U.S. imperialism, you're taking a good step forward, and that means rejecting patriotism, rejecting putting this country before the people of the world. We have to put the people of the world first. We live in an empire that plunders vast sections of the planet and keeps.
I think you've asked a good question, and for our audience, there's probably awareness of the reasons that lead you to do that. In terms of would the world be better off with America, there's of course different views. We might talk about throwing out the bathwater with the baby. It's not a very good analogy for America. What do you think, Deborah? World better off without America?
That's a loaded question.
That's a loaded question. I think
remember
you know, again,
Patriot Act.
Right.
Is out there.
The duty not to impose harm on others is a fundamental duty, and that's regardless of whether they're your own citizens or not. So I agree with the caller. You know, to the extent that America has been involved in harming others. Right. That's something. And again, as an American citizen, I take very seriously my responsibility to try and change my government's mind and protest its policies where I believe they've led to harm.
But on the other hand, nobody else has got the money and the resources, both in terms of money and all sorts of other stuff and capital, and also the a functioning democracy, at least up till now. Those are things the world really needs, don't you think?
Yes, I think we have enormous capacity to do good, and I would like to see us doing more good. In particular, the developed world gives almost nothing in aid to the world's poorest countries. You know, if you think of just a few hundred years ago, slavery was widely accepted. It's now changed. In today's world, it's widely accepted that giving 0.2% of your GDP to global poverty, to fighting global poverty, is acceptable. And I'm hoping in a few hundred years we'll look back and think that wasn't acceptable.
Yeah, I'm afraid in a few hundred years they'll look back on me and they'll say, good Lord, he ate meat. He didn't give much to Oxfam. What a pig. But anyway,
looks like you're holding an email question.
We have an email question from somebody in our vast worldwide audience. This particular person's in North Carolina, and his name's Steve. Mm-hmm. And Steve says, if our Americanness is just a random accident of birth, how can we feel pride in it? Doesn't pride imply that you had a choice in the matter? That's a good and pretty deep question.
Let me take on that question, because it goes back to something I want to say against both you guys. I mean, I don't think the Patriot is having quite a fair hearing yet in this argument. America, you say, it's a random act of birth that you were born here. But this thing, I'm not sure about, I mean, we might make a distinction.
I'm not sure it was random. My folks both were in America, so right. It would have been a bit of a miracle if I'd been born anywhere else.
But no, this thing, this America, this shared life that we have, this is a big, important thing in shaping who we are, what we value. It's a source of our identity. It's not just some overlay. It's not just some accident. We grow up, we shape our self-consciousness. Our life story is part of the life story, a part of the history of America. And so it's a source of deep and important things. And you could argue that it's a virtue to want to protect, to want to perfect and protect and make that community flourish.
Okay, Ken, I think that's a good point. It is part of our identity, and it's probably a good thing that a lot of people identify with these larger groups of which are a part. But I still think Steve has a point. It's still a matter of luck and not of pride. I think I'm lucky to have been American, but I'm not proud to have been American. I might be proud for the job I've done once I had that piece of luck, or I might be ashamed.
Deborah, do you want to weigh in there, or should I go to a caller?
Yeah, I agree with John. It is an accident, and the fact that it's an accident that I'm an American should give me an appreciation. I could have been a Bosnian, and so I have to keep that perspective in mind. But on the other hand, having said that, I'm engaged in a project which has accomplished some very good things and some very bad things, and has, and I have a relation to that project that's different than my relation to the projects of other nations.
Yeah, we have lots of callers on the line. Let me let Jerome in Richmond join our discussion.
Yes, thank you. Boy, it's kind of inspirational, and I'm not a philosopher. But you caused a little bit of a thought storm in my brain. So
that's what we aim for.
Cool, that's our whole whatever you call it, razzing it.
It seems I want to say blah 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 blah, because
my thoughts exactly.
It's a verbal convention that then can be used to direct energies from the people one way or another. So then, when the explanation is, well, why did you drop that bomb on Hiroshima? It's patriotism, or why did you do this thing for another reason or not another reason, or why did you get in front of that bulldozer trying to stop something and get run over? It's patriotism. But what does a philosopher, how does the philosopher penetrate the contradictions, the paradoxes of a term like patriotism and make it explainable to people like me?
Well, Jerome, that's what we're trying to do here. Thank you very much for the call.
You make a very important point, Jerome, which is words have a certain magic. I mean, patriotism is a word that's, been involved in quotations and precedents cited, and people do what they have to do to be patriotic because they're taught from day one that loyalty is very important. Notice that you don't have to teach people that 2 + 2 = 4. You just mention it once and they know it. But loyalty and patriotism, you have to drum in their brains. There's a lesson there. Ambrose Bierce, our local San Francisco philosopher, said, "A patriot, patriotism is combustible rubbish ready to the torch of any tyrant." we're saying that there's another side.
Yeah, there's a dark side and a light side. There's a dark side and light side to many different things. There are two ways you can join us. You can call us at 415-841-4134, or you can write us an email at comments@philosophytalk.org. Or you can also go to our webpage and click on the comments link. We'll take your question online. I still think that we need to think more about the virtue of patriotism. In a moment, the 60-second philosopher Ian Scholes gives us some background on Diogenes, the man who claimed to be citizen of the world.
There's more on Philosophy Talk after this short break.
My 100% for Uncle Sam. Patriotic flag wave is what I am.
A song called Patriotic Flag Waver from Dr. John. I'm the other Dr. John, Dr. John Perry, Doctor of Philosophy, or at any rate, Professor of Philosophy, at any rate, a teacher of philosophy. And you're listening to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Dr. Ken, that doesn't sound the same. This week, we've been looking at patriotism and cosmopolitanism. And each week at this time, we get the lowdown on a philosopher of the past who did some important thinking about our topic.
This time, Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher, looks at the life of Diogenes. So brace yourself for a race through Greek legend. Ready? Go!
Ian Scholes, the word cynic in ancient Greece meant dog and referred to those philosophers who believed in a stripped-down natural life unfettered by social customs. Cynics were kind of like hippies, only articulate. The archetypal cynic was Diogenes of Sinope, often called a dog because he ate and relieved himself where he pleased. When he saw a child drinking water with his hands, he threw away his cup, saying, "That child has beaten me in simplicity." Chided for eating food in a market, he said, "But that's where I was hungry." Alexander the Great once approached him and said, "I am Alexander the Great King." And Diogenes replied, "I am Diogenes the dog." When asked why, he said, "Because I fawn upon those who give me anything, bark at those who give me nothing, and bite the rogues." Actual information about Diogenes is scanty, but there are tons of good stories. He was the guy with a lamp looking for an honest man. He was the guy who lived in a barrel, well, a clay jar, really. He was the guy who told Alexander the Great to get out of the way, he was blocking the sun. And when asked once what country he was from, he said he was a citizen of the world, making him the first person in recorded history to claim global citizenship. He came to Athens at 60, it said, having been banished with his father, who ran the local bank in Sinope, and was caught with his hand in the till. Diogenes may or may not have been complicit. When an Athenian reproached him for that crime, however, he replied, "There was a time when I was such a person as you are now, but there never was when you were such as I am now, and never will be." He was famous for his mockery. When Plato defined man as a featherless biped, Diogenes plucked a chicken, held it up, and said, "Here's Plato's man." A man asked him if he believed in the gods. He said, "How can I help thinking so when I consider you to be hated by them?" He called out once, "Hello, men." When people turned around, he said, "I said men, not dregs." Despite all this, or maybe because of it, when he was not getting beat up, he was apparently much liked by Athenians. He was supposedly 90 when he died, either from eating raw meat, from a dog bite, or plain old age. He was the first cynic, the first global citizen, the first insult comic, and the first homeless person. When asked why people give money to beggars and not philosophers, he said, "Because they think it's possible they might themselves one day become lame and blind, but they do not expect ever to become philosophers." He once asked that a statue be built of himself. When asked why, he said, "I am practicing disappointment. I gotta go."
Diogenes sounds like kind of an ancient Don Rickles. And Ian Scholes, both of them are always welcome at Philosophy Corner anytime. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk. Our guest today is another Stanford philosopher, Professor Deborah Satz. Deborah, I have a question for you. I still think you and John are giving the cosmopolitan line too easy a go here, and I want to just try and challenge you for another minute. Look, Diogenes, I think he was being ironical when he answered that question. Because there was no cosmopolitan. What's that mean? The polis, the city of the whole, right, of the total. There is no city of the total. There is no political community that's a political community of all. There's nothing to be a citizen of. I'm a citizen of America. America is one nation among others. These nations have these relations to one another, minimal relations. I want you to tell me more about I can imagine taking it as a project to make a global community, but that's a project barely begun and nowhere near completion.
Well, I agree. We better hurry up with it because we're getting this global economy. If you have a global economy without a global polis, that's true. You basically got oligarchy or one of those bad things.
So for our time, there's an urgency to this question, but it's a culturally specific moment in history that makes this question have this urgency. Well, what do you think about that, Deborah?
There is a weak, I'd say, global community. I wouldn't characterize cosmopolitanism in terms of citizen of the world for precisely the reasons that you said. To be a citizen is to have some, you know, special connections to a governing body that makes laws that govern you, and that's not true in the international case. On the other hand, there is a weak set of international institutions. And particularly the UN, a bunch of conventions on rules of war, on human rights that are meant to apply globally. And I think a cosmopolitan is somebody who says those matter. You know, we can't just do what we want without taking into account other outsiders.
Ken's got me over on the cosmopolitan side, but I'm a little worried. I mean, I'm glad to be on your side, Deborah, but Peter Singer, I don't know about that. Mm-hmm. He's He's a utilitarian, but deep down he's a rationalist, right? He thinks that, you know, you kind of have these rational arguments that produce this obligation to help not just the kid that falls in the pond on your way to work, but the kid that you see on TV that you can save for 25 cents a day and all that. Now, I think it's fine to save the kid for 25 cents a day, but I just think there's something weird about that rationalism. It seems to me that we're lucky that people have this feeling of this sentiment, as Hume would say, of wanting to help people that they are close to. And maybe we can manipulate those bonds if for some reason we think it's good for them to help other people by putting the people on TV so it's as if they were close to them. But this rationalism that, you know, makes, like Godwin, you said, makes... I'm going to save my mother or some stranger. I'm going to save my mother. Are you that rationalistic?
No.
Is your mother listening?
My son may be listening.
Yeah, right. Parenthood does something to you in that regard.
I don't think, you know, I think of the identification with other human beings as I said, a sort of leap of faith. It is a sentiment. And I don't think you can get it rationally, but I think it's a sentiment that we need to cultivate. The failures of that sentiment, and I should say the sentiment, I mean, we're not there, even within people who are fellow citizens, many of the fellow citizens, most of them in the United States, are strangers to me.
Right.
So they're not, I don't see them. I don't really know what their lives are like. But without some kind of broader sentiments, we have Rwanda and Bosnia.
Yeah, you're right. There's darkness lurking around the corner. I agree with you. We have a caller on the line, Josh in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Josh.
Thanks. I was just wondering, I need your guys' help. I'm finding it difficult to feel patriotic about America because of the very way the country was established, particularly in regards to the displacement of the Native American population and the enslavement of African peoples. And I can't figure out how to be patriotic about a country that I feel was founded on exploitation, and I just wanted to know your thoughts on that.
I'll tell you my thought on that. My ancestors were brought over here in slave ships, and I wrestle with this from time to time myself. But I think this, America, it was founded partly on an ideal that it didn't live up to, hasn't lived up to, but it's a grand ideal, and we as Americans have a special obligation to hold America to that ideal, to work for the moral perfection of America, and I think that's a deep kind of patriotism.
If you feel bad about the displacement of Native Americans and feel that you ought to work to do something about it, to help the Black Hills be returned to the Sioux or whatever seems to you the right answer, that's a form of patriotism. It may not be recognized as such by some of the rednecks, but at least the way Ken's been defining it, a cooperative venture to make the whole place better, including redressing the wrongs as much as we can, that's a form of patriotism, wouldn't you say so, Ken?
Yeah, but there is a dark side even to that. It's patriotism says my country. Even if it's not morally perfect, it's still my country. It's still an object of my devotion. It's not that I love it because it is morally perfect. It's I love it even in the absence of its moral perfection. So that is a problem. Do you agree, Deborah?
I want to just emphasize that, you know, love of country or attachment to country has to be bounded in some way by allegiances and loyalties that go beyond country. And I'm actually thinking here of Martin Luther King, who, when he broke silence among the civil rights leaders and came out against the Vietnam War, he was attacked because it was seen as, why are you dealing with that problem, right? We should work on, you know, getting African Americans in the United States civil standing. This is a distraction. And he said, no, I can't simply limit my perspective. I have to look at what's happening in the rest of the world.
Those seem like words of wisdom, Deborah. And I want to thank you, really, for joining us. It's been a very interesting discussion.
Well, thank you.
And, Deborah, on your way back to the office, keep your eye open for drowning children and widows you can pull from the flames. And if your mother's in there, pull her out first, okay? Goodbye, Deborah. Thanks a lot.
Goodbye. Thank you very much.
So, John, you got any wisdom? Are you wiser? I know you're already wise, but...
Well, when I looked through the quotes for this show, just in an uncharacteristic moment of research, some people draw a distinction between patriotism and nationalism. One guy, and I don't know who says this, the difference between patriotism and nationalism is that the patriot is proud of his country for what it does, and the nationalist is proud of his country no matter what it does. The first attitude creates a feeling of responsibility, but the second a feeling of blind arrogance that leads to war. I think we as Americans, it's such a powerful country and has such an influence on the people of the world, really have an obligation to try to think this through. And, I think I got started today, but I'm not done.
Yeah, I think you're right. There is a lot to think through. I do think, though, I really do believe that the project of a global community, a global moral community, is that, a project. It's not yet finished. We have a long way to go.
It's time for conundrums, or is that conundrums? I forget.
That's conundrums, John.
Well, what the world's a conundrum? That's a big fancy word for
that's me. A puzzle that bedevils a person that they can't solve, and so they call us with their conundrum. And we have a caller on the line now, John. Mara Lee from Wood Village, Oregon.
Hi.
Where in Oregon is Wood Village?
Wood Village is a tiny little incorporated town about 10 or 15 miles east of Portland.
Which is a tiny little incorporated town near Eugene. Right?
Yes, just joking. Why don't you describe to us your conundrum? What's your puzzle?
I'm a parent with three adopted kids, now adults, and as happens with most adoptive parents, I'm frequently have been asked things like, "What do you know about your kids' real parents?" Or I'm told things like, "It's too bad I didn't have my own natural children." I think that really invalidates the adoptive relationship and makes it seem tentative. And oftentimes, I think we adoptive parents even feel like people see us as more or less babysitters or people doing a noble task, but somehow that relationship is not the same, not quite as good.
Merrily, that's an interesting conundrum. I must say, I think I must be remarkably well qualified to answer it because I have two non-adoptive children and one adoptive child.
Okay.
And I'm also a philosopher. But I'm going to put on my philosopher's hat
all
first.
Right.
Whenever people use the word real, 90% of the time, it doesn't mean much of anything except contrast to whatever you were talking about. If they could say, well, do you know anything about the biological father, which would be a much nicer thing to say, I think. I try to avoid the word real, and whenever I hear it, I try to avoid being offended by it.
Yeah, I mean, I am also an adoptive parent, and so this question means a lot to me, too, Merrily. But I do think the word real is trying to do some work there, whether it's legitimate work or not. Real is trying to privilege a biological relation over some other relation.
Yeah, thank you. That says it well.
Yeah, so, and the question is that privileging deserved? It seems to me that it's not, but we should think philosophically about why it's not, John.
Well, the situation here is like a lot of things. You have one word and a whole number of things in the most typical, paradigmatic, or familiar situation go together. That's being the biological parent, being the parent who cares for the child, being the parent who pays for the child, being the parent who emotionally is most tied to the child.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you separate one of those things, does the word still apply? Well, yes, it does. I mean, suppose that you and your husband are each 7-footers, and you've got a little boy that's adopted. He's 2 years old, and you want to make a deal with the owner of the local basketball team that if he'll pay all his educational expenses, you guarantee that he'll sign up with his team when he's old. And if he says, well, wait a minute, are you really his parents? I think that's a legitimate worry because he knows that the inherited characteristics won't come from you, but from somebody else. Uh-huh. But in most contexts, it seems to me the person who does the caring, who has the emotions, who pays the bills, who visits the principals, who cleans up the scrapes and cuts, that's about as real as it gets.
That certainly is a real relationship, and I think it deserves, I mean, I certainly think, because I'm in one such relationship, it deserves to be honored as a parenting relationship. On the other hand, you know, I do think that to recognize the biological bond is something with some significance is an important
thing.
Yeah. Right? But it doesn't mean that it's real and the other one isn't real.
If none of this helps, find new friends.
Yeah. No, I am usually pretty patient with people who say these things. Sometimes not, but usually I just take it as an opportunity to educate.
Well, thank you for listening.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Now, don't be shy. I'll bet you have some sort of conundrum you've been wrestling with.
A riddle or puzzle that troubles you, bedevils your imagination?
Here's what to do. You send us an email describing your conundrum. You send it to conundrums@philosophytalk.org.
Be sure, if you do that, to tell us where we can reach you, just in case we pick you for our program. Once again, that's conundrums@philosophytalk.org.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2004.
Executive producer, Gordon Earle.
Our production team includes Peter Crimmins, Amy Standen, Monica Blakely, Alex Martinez, Jim Swenson, Merle Kessler, Matt Bauer, Alan Acosta, and Olgan Kramer of Whitetail Web Design.
Special thanks to Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institute, the Greenwald Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
And that's not all. It comes from the Provost Office at Stanford University, the Dean of Humanities and Sciences, Stanford's Office of Public Affairs, the Stanford Humanities Center, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, that's you, the members of KALW Information Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates. They make our shoestring possible.
The views expressed on this program do not necessarily or even remotely plausibly represent the opinions of Stanford University or our funders.
For more information, visit our website at Philosophy Talk, www.philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you so much for listening.
And thank you for thinking.